From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, sitting in for Terry Gross. Two sitcoms, one about an everyday blue-collar guy and the other about a judge presiding over a wacky night court, are now out on DVD. On today's Fresh Air, we feature interviews with Drew Carey, star of The Drew Carey Show, and with con man-turned-actor Harry Anderson, star of Night Court. Also, composer and lyricist Richard Adler tells us about writing The Pajama Game and Damn Yankees. The Pajama Game is currently back on Broadway. And classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz tells us about some eye-popping performances of the tap dance team The Nicholas Brothers. Many of their films are now available on DVD. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, TV critic for the New York Daily News, sitting in for Terry Gross. Two TV comics with relatively untamed senses of humor are being showcased next week in new DVD box set collections. One is Drew Carey, the other is Harry Anderson. Today, we revisit Terry's interviews with them both, starting with Drew Carey. The Drew Carey Show premiered in 1995 on ABC and ran for 9 years. Even though it was a mainstream hit, it had an outsider's sensibility. Carey came from Cleveland, Ohio, and filled his workplace sitcom with oddball talent. Talent like Kathy Kinney, who played the abrasive Mimi, and Ryan Stiles, who would also be one of the standout stars of Carey's improv comedy series, Whose Line Is It Anyway? As a stand-up comic, Carey loved to push the envelope with suggestive or potentially offensive material. And even on The Drew Carey Show, he made a practice of delighting audiences while aggravating censors. Here he is taping a workplace video on sexual harassment with help from co-stars Diedrich Bader and Krista Miller.
Hey, Drew, can I talk to you for a minute?
Yeah, sure, sit down.
This is kind of hard for me to talk about, but I think my boss might be coming on to me, and I'm not sure what to do.
I'm sorry, I wasn't listening. I was staring at your breasts. This is sexual harassment, and I'm Drew Carey. It's important to define what is and isn't appropriate behavior in the workplace. The difference can be something as subtle as tone of voice. For example.
Yes, ma'am? You wanted a package delivered?
Yeah, just one question. Can I get it overnight?
No problem there. But change the tone of voice and...
Yes, ma'am? You wanted a package delivered?
Yeah, just one question. Can I get it overnight?
I don't know.
If I can't get it overnight, can you guarantee it by morning?
Whoa! She stopped talking about a real package a long time ago.
When not on a sitcom, Drew Carey tends to push even further in several directions. Once, when hosting a Television Critics Association award show, Carey told some jokes that made the aristocrats seem tame, even though General Fred Rogers was one of the honorees that night, sitting right in front of him. Afterward, Rogers shook it off sweetly, saying, "That was just Drew enjoying being a bad boy." He does seem to enjoy it, too. His book, Dirty Jokes and Beer, is a collection of some very funny jokes and humorous observations. It also includes some not-so-funny stuff about his suicide attempts and his father's death. Terry spoke with Drew Carey in 1997 and talked with him about his TV show, his books, and, of course, Dirty Jokes.
One of the chapters in your book is really a scream. It's 101 very funny jokes about the male member.
Yeah.
That's
a good way to put it for radio, sure.
Yeah. And these jokes are really funny.
My friends and I started doing them. I started with John Campanera on The Good Life when he showed me his one day as a joke. And I said, "What do you call that?" And I was making jokes about, you know, mine is so big that, and he went, "Oh yeah, well mine is so big that." And we started making up these jokes. And I started remembering all of them in my head. And my friends would get together and we'd mention this thing, they'd always add in their own jokes. Everybody thought it was so funny, they'd try to add in their own jokes. And I started writing all these down, and pretty soon I had 101 of them. And most all of them I wrote myself, but a lot of them came from my friends, and I credit them in the book. But they're really funny.
Can you tell a couple of them?
It's so big, it's right behind you. It's so big, there's still snow on it in the summertime. It's so big. Oh, wow, I'm trying to clean these up for the radio. It's so big it graduated a year ahead of me from high school. It's so big, Stephen Hawking has a theory about it. I love that one. It's so big, it has an opening act. It's so big, it only tips with hundreds. It's so big, it contains billions and billions of stars. It's so big.
It doesn't return Spielberg's calls.
It doesn't return Spielberg's calls. That's pretty big.
Wow, that's really funny.
It's so big, my mother was in labor for 3 extra days.
Oh, there's another joke I have to ask you to tell. This is the one about the beautiful woman who compliments the comic. I love this.
Oh, yeah, I think that's a clean one. That's like a typical comic insecurity joke. There's this comic gets he's in the bar Friday night and he's done working, and there's this really the most stunningly beautiful woman he's ever seen in his life sitting at the bar, and she says, "You were so funny tonight. I never laugh so hard. I think you're the sexiest guy in the world. I want to take you back to my place and make the most, the hottest love with you and just give you the wildest sexual trip you've ever had in your whole entire life right now." And he looks at her and he goes, "Did you see the first show or the second show?"
That is so great. I've heard that for jazz musicians too, where the beautiful woman comes up to a jazz musician and he says, "So did you hear the first set or the second set?"
Yeah.
it's the best joke about self-absorbed artists I've heard.
There's a lot of those going around.
Yeah, yeah. You know, in your book, you seem to really want to communicate that you're not the TV character, Drew Carey, that he's a lot more lovable than
yeah,
you,
he is. He
than
puts
you really
the guy
are.
The guy on TV puts up with so much more crap than I would ever put up with in my, mm-hmm. my life. And I have so much more ambition in my real life than the guy on TV does. You know, if that was the real Drew, I would have quit that job and try to start my own business. And, you know, I mean, a real business where I could make money. Buzz Beer isn't going so good on this show. But, yeah, I mean, when you're writing a book, it's like a personal letter, you know, almost to like, to strangers. And so you want to let them know, like, hey, this is me, and I'm not, you know, you want to write it in your own voice and try to be some TV guy. Because
mm-hmm.
I think the book, you know, I'm writing it, that was scaring me that the book might be around more than the TV show, you know. The book can sit around for a long time after the TV show's come and gone. It could be sitting on somebody's bookshelf in a library, you know, who knows.
Yeah, but the reruns come back to haunt you anyways.
Yeah, I know, but, yeah, hopefully.
That's right, if you're lucky.
In a perfect world, yeah.
Do you think you've managed to transform the 1950s square look into something really hip?
Maybe. You know, the only reason when I first started doing the act, I had the crew cut already and the glasses already from the Marine Corps Reserves. And I wore contact lenses when I was at work being a waiter. And then when I got off work, I'd take the contacts out and I put on my goofy glasses. I never knew how bad they looked until I started going on stage with them and people would laugh at me. The suit I bought at a Goodwill and... because that movie Stop Making Sense had just been out, and I thought, if I got a big, you know, old style suit, that would be really hip to wear, and I look so bad in it, I can never wear it out. And I only wore it on stage to see if it would get a laugh for me, and it did. And so, I mean, it's not like I really tried all that hard to create a character, because it was pretty much just me in a Goodwill suit that I'd already bought, you know, before I just started doing stand up. But it might be a look. I don't know. Who knows?
Did the Marines make you wear those glasses?
Those are the official glasses. They have different ones now, but I think they let guys wear a certain kind of wires now. But then those were the official government-issued glasses. And when you had an inspection and stuff, that's what you had to wear. And during your work day, you could wear wire rims, you know. But for inspections and stuff like that, you had to wear the black, ugly. In the Marines, they call them, all through the service, they call them birth control glasses.
That's funny.
BCGs, yeah. And that's exactly why, too. They're so ugly.
You know, you write in your book that, you know, you don't know what humiliation is until you've shown up on your first day of junior high with moon boots and a snowsuit that your mother got on sale during the summer. Did your mother dress you badly when you were young?
No, it's just that, you know, she would. She would buy, like, the winter stuff on sale during the summer because that's when it's the cheapest. And she'd buy, you know, Christmas stuff for next year after Christmas when it all goes on sale before it gets all put away. And so... you know, you don't get the coolest stuff all the time when your mom's shopping like that because, you know, we didn't have a lot of money growing up. And but it's cold, man. I'm telling you, it gets cold in the winter in Cleveland, so you have to wear what you can to keep warm. I remember mom used to say, "Do you want to look good or do you want to stay warm?" And then after you get to be about 14 or 15, you think, heck, you know, I'm not even wearing a hat. That was like the big thing in my high school. Nobody wore a hat no matter what, no matter how cold. They would all let, you know, I would come home from wrestling practice or gym or whatever, my hair would be wet still, and I'd walk home. I would refuse to put a hat on because I didn't want to get hat hair. I have icicles in my hair. It'd be like the stupidest thing. And everybody in my school was like that except for the nerds, you know. They would wear the hats, and I didn't want to be one of them.
Right, 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 right. Ooh, where would you have fit yourself in those days?
I don't know. I never, I was always pretty well known and pretty popular. I mean, I was one of those kids that walked down the hall in high school without a pass, and everybody knew me.
Right.
You know? And all my friends were really funny, and I hung out with a group of guys that were all really funny and liked to joke around a lot and play pranks and stuff. So I was in whatever that group is. That's the group I was in. And I wasn't very athletic, you know. And you know, I didn't want to go through high school without trying out for a sport. there was an announcement over the loudspeaker one day. Any boys interested in trying out for wrestling, come to the gym and bring your gym clothes. And so I tried out for wrestling. For 2 years, I went to wrestling practice, never even wrestled JV. I was really bad, but I really liked it. It taught me a lot, you know, about sticking to it and stuff. But it was like, I'm glad I had a sport experience in high school. And then I graduated a year early, so I only had the 2 years, and I skipped my senior year.
Hmm.
You know, so I wasn't very athletic. I didn't do anything great that way. And then academically, I wasn't so hot. I got a B average without even trying. I mean, you just have to show up for class and take the test.
Well, you were funny in high school. Did you say to yourself, well, I could do this professionally?
I always say no in interviews. But then when I had a development deal at Disney once, and they were thinking of doing a show about me, and I had my mom send out all these pictures of me from when I was a kid and all this stuff. She has a little file about, you know, like every mom does. And so one of the things in this file that she sent was, I think I wrote it when I was 14 or so, judging from the handwriting, and it was on steno paper, and I wrote down, like, things I wanted to do with my life, or be, you know. And on this list was stuff like, I want to be on the Johnny Carson show, I want to be a stand-up, I want to be a nightclub comic, I want to have a sitcom, I want to, you know, I want to star in a situation comedy or a play or something like that. It was all these kind of things that I'm doing now that I wrote down when I was 14, and then I just forgot about.
That's interesting.
You know,
yeah.
It freaked me out. It really freaked me out. I had no idea, you know, because I didn't know what I wanted to do. When I started doing stand-up comedy in my late 20s, I didn't know what I wanted to do with my life. I had no goals, no direction, nothing. I just kind of fell into it. And so to see that list from when I was like 14 or 15 or whatever, however I was old when I wrote it, and I was like, wow, it must have been in the back of my mind somewhere.
Maybe you forgot it, you know? Because it seems like such a long shot that it, you know, you didn't take it seriously.
Yeah, it's like one of these like big, it's like, you know, there was also stuff like, you know, pet a pony, you know, so. But it was like, I used to watch, when I was in junior high and high school, I used to watch The Tonight Show all the time if there was a comic on. I wouldn't watch The Johnny Carson Show normally, only if there was a comic.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd always look at the TV guide. If it said comedian so-and-so, I'd always make sure I'd watch and see who the comic was. And I think that's where I got the idea that, I would love to do that someday. And I wrote down, you know, be a nightclub comic, be on The Johnny Carson Show. And it all came true. I can't believe, you know, it's weird.
Drew Carey speaking with Terry Gross in 1997. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's 1997 interview with Drew Carey. A new DVD called Television Favorites, The Drew Carey Show, collects some of his favorite episodes.
You enlisted in the Marine Reserve Corps.
Right.
How old were you when you did it? What was your motivation?
I was like 23, I must have been. It was in 80. I needed money. I needed a job. I was... it was always in the back, you know, I must have been from playing with Army men when I was a kid or something, but it's always, you know, being in the military was always in the back of my mind as a last resort. If nothing else ever worked out, you could always join the Army. You know, that's always how I thought. And I was living in Las Vegas and having a really bad time, and I got thrown out of my motel room that I was living in because I couldn't pay the rent. And I had my car that was totaled in the first place, had everything stolen out of it. So all it was left with was like the clothes on my back and a few other things that they didn't take. And so my buddy gave me a ride to L.A. to stay with my brother, who lived in Mission Viejo. My brother took me in and got me a job, bought me some clothes. And he worked for a Porsche Audi dealer, and I would deliver parts in Southern California in this van. That was my job. And he was the parts manager. And when the owner of the place found out that he didn't want relatives working for relatives because it would be easy to steal from the place then. And so my brother had to fire me from that job.
Oh, no.
So I was in Mission Viejo. My brother had to fire me, and I didn't want to mooch off him, you know. And all I had was a little bit of clothes that he bought me. He had to buy me underwear and everything. I didn't have anything when I showed up at his door because everything was stolen out of my car after I got kicked out of my motel room. And so I thought, I'll just join the service. And I went to the recruiting office, and I went to the Navy thing, and I talked to those guys. And while I was in the, before I could go in, I was in the lobby, and the Marine guy came out and saw me, And he looked really squared away and everything. He said, "Look, make sure you see me before you leave." So after I saw the Navy guys, I went over to visit with the Marine guy. And he was, you know, he was just a good salesman, man. He talked me into joining the Marines. And I thought, if I'm going to join the service, I just want to join the toughest one, you know, and get it over with. I don't want to say, don't want to take the easy way out from this. I'm just doing this one time, you know, because you can't, like, you just can't switch branches of service throughout your life and go through boot camp after boot camp. So I joined the Marines, and it was great.
What was great about it?
I really liked it. Well, first of all, I got 3 meals a day. I was earning my own money. I was so happy to, I mean, after that, you know, mooching off my brother and getting kicked out of my motel in Vegas, I was so happy just to have a job. And they really are good at building like a team spirit and a camaraderie, you know, and every day you get done, you really feel like you've been doing something, you know, and accomplishing something. And I was running and getting in shape and, you know. And I was older than a lot of the guys in the platoon, you know, so I knew what they were doing, like, psychologically when they were doing stuff to me. So, I mean, they could yell. I just stood there. It didn't bother me, you know. I knew they weren't out to hurt me. So everything they said to do, I would just do it as fast as I could right away. And I trusted them, you know. And a lot of people think you go to boot camp and they go, oh, the drill instructor's out to really, he's going to try to hurt you. That's his job. But it's not his job. The drill instructor's job is to make you into a Marine and to get you through this training. And all you have to do is, I'm telling you, I just totally trusted him. I thought, this guy's really not going to hurt me. You know, I just got to do what he says. And so that's all I did. And it came out, it worked out really well. I graduated from boot camp with a meritorious PFC. I got a top 10% of my, they give the guys in the top 10% of the platoon a meritorious promotion. So I got meritorious PFC out of boot camp, and really did good. I really liked the reserves. I had a lot of friends. I liked the life. You know,
this is great. Really, the Marines kind of gave you a sense of accomplishment, a sense of self-esteem, and a look.
Yeah, yeah. I know, the Marines were pretty good to me. I'm telling you, man, I'd still be in the Marine Reserves if I wasn't doing stand-up. I quit because I was making, you know, I saw the money you could make doing weekends, and I was only making like $125 a weekend in the reserves as a sergeant, you know. And I thought, you know, then I could make $300 on a weekend if I was a stand-up comic starting out. So why would I give up that $300, you know, for the home 120s? I quit during the Marines.
What was your first brush with professional comedy?
Just doing the, working that one club in Canton. I lived in Cleveland, and the guy that owned the Cleveland club owned a club in Canton. He put me in his Canton club for a week. 9 shows for $100. That was my first professional paid gig. I got like $10 a show.
What was your first time on stage like?
Oh, the very first time I ever tried to do jokes on stage, I was living in Las Vegas, and it was horrible. I was terrible. I tried, you know, I didn't know how to write jokes. I just, you know, kind of like jokes that I kind of heard, and, you know, observations that weren't funny that were like, oh my God, it was like the worst. I still have notes from those days that I save, and oh my God, the worst. Ugh. I can't tell you how bad. That was in 79, and then like in 8. I just did it as a goof just to see what it would be like. It was the Sahara Talent Showcase at the Sahara Hotel, their lounge. They let anybody get up there. And then I went to Cleveland in 80, and there was a guy starting a comedy club there and late 79, early 80, and he wanted local comics, and he just put me on just for, because I could breathe and stand up and talk. And I remember the very first time, he didn't pay the MCs. He only paid the headliners. I didn't get any money, but he worked me once. And I remember the first night I did, it was Thursday, Friday, Saturday. And the first night I did 5 minutes, or 10 minutes, supposed to do 10 minutes. Then Friday, they said, why don't you do just 5? And then Saturday, they said, look, don't do any time. Just bring the other guys up. They cut me down. They didn't want me to just do anything because I was that bad. I think I did it twice. And then I said, well, I can't do this. This is silly. You know, at least I tried it and got it out of my system. I was going to college then and everything. And I thought, I'll just, you know, I did it as a goof. I got it out of my system. I won't try it again. And I never did. And I thought, well, that was just it. So then later on in 86, when my, you know, in late 85, my friend said, hey, he remembered from when I used to be I met him when I tried to do stand-up. He always thought it was funny. And when I was having trouble, you know, paying rent, I got in a fight with my boss where I was waiting tables. And he said, hey, if you want to think of any jokes for my radio show, I'll pay you. I went, oh, how much? And he gives $20 a joke or so. And I thought, oh, I can make an extra $100 a week. And I went to the library and I finally got a book on how to write jokes. And from reading that book, that's what really started me. I thought, oh, wow, there's a formula to this. I could write jokes.
How did the book help you write jokes?
There's formulas for every kind of joke writing. I mean, there really is.
Give me an example.
Easily learned. Well, the example they used in the book, For example, usually they take driving. You write driving at the top of the page, and then you write down. It's all about list making, joke writing, writing one-liners. It's all about list making. So you write driving, then you write down everything you can think of that relates to driving. You know, angry drivers, slow drivers, fast drivers, new cars, old cars, junk cars, car washes, red lights, and you write all this stuff down, and then you try to exaggerate something to make it bigger than it is. You try to use plays on words. If there's words that sound like other words, you try to make puns up that way. You can make jokes like that. And you use all these different techniques to take all these little lists you made, and even angry women drivers, angry men drivers, and you try to, when you detail it down, you try to make every little thing and exaggerate it or minimalize it or twist it around. And then you try to make 20 jokes and try to get one good joke out of that. And that's how you come up with one good joke. It should take, if you're starting out, it takes you like 3 hours.
I can't believe you actually honed your technique through a book.
Yeah, yeah. I'm really big on self-help, so I always try to get a book at the library or a book on whatever I want to learn. I try to learn it from some kind of book.
Well, Drew Carey, it's really been fun having you on the show. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Oh, thank you.
Drew Carey speaking to Terry Gross in 1997. A new Warner Brothers home video release called Television Favorites: The Drew Carey Show comes out next week, presenting 6 of the show's best episodes. I'm David Bean Cooley, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of Emily Bronte's Wuthering Heights, available in stores and online at bn.com. From Wellington Management, providing investment management for clients worldwide. And from the Ford Foundation, a resource for innovative people and institutions worldwide. On the web at fordfound.org. This is NPR. National Public Radio.
Coming up, composer and lyricist Richard Adler tells us about writing The Pajama Game, which is currently back on Broadway. Also, how did a con man end up playing a judge on TV? Harry Anderson tells us. Selections from his sitcom Night Court are now out on DVD. And Lloyd Schwartz tells us about some stunning performances now available on DVD by the tap dance team The Nicholas Brothers. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley, in for Terry Gross. Warner Brothers Home Video is releasing 2 box sets next week starring TV comedians featured on today's show. We've already heard a mouthful from Drew Carey. Now we hear from Harry Anderson, who from 1984 to 1992 played Judge Harry Stone on the sitcom Night Court. Before starring in his own series, Anderson appeared on Saturday Night Live and on the streets of several cities, doing card tricks, magic tricks, and con artist stunts. Now he's gone legit. Last year, he opened a club called Oswald's Speakeasy in New Orleans and weathered the storm of Katrina with significant damage, but more determined than ever to make it a success. He's also written books about how to cheat at cards and pull other cons, including Games You Can't Lose, which was published in 1989. That's when Terry spoke with him and asked about one of his early stunts as a street performer in San Francisco, where he chopped off his own hand.
What you do is you buy a phony hand at the magic shop, and you get a loaf of French bread, and you hollow out one end of the French bread, and you stick the phony hand in there. It's a baguette, a long loaf, about the diameter of an arm. And then in the other end, you take a turkey baster, and you fill it with stage blood, and you stick that in the other end. Then you take an old shirt, you cut the sleeve off, and you put that around the bread. Now, standing at my table, and on the street I used to wear this big robe, I would reach over with one hand and get this ugly-looking cleaver, and at the same time, using that distraction, I would grab this phony hand and pull my arm up into the robe, bring the phony hand down on the table, bring the meat cleaver through the bread, and a cleaver going through crunchy French bread really does, if you think you're going through somebody's arm, does give you the sound of gristle and bone. It's remarkable. Then I would hit this turkey baster a couple of times, and the stage blood would go everywhere, and it was sensational. And I thought, this is gonna kill him. So I did it once. I got it all set, went out there, did it once. The crowd absolutely freaked out, turned on me. A guy came up and punched me in the face. And I didn't do it anymore.
They must have thought you were psychotic.
Well, they were waiting to see Jaws. I mean, I thought I was playing the crowd. They didn't throw a lot of money at me, no.
Is there a lesson in this about how extreme you can get?
You can't get that extreme, I think. That's the lesson.
Did you ever run Real Swindles before it actually became an act?
Did I run Real Swindles? Oh, yeah. I mean, I started as a... On the street, I did not begin as a performer. I began running the shell game. And, again, another experience with a dissatisfied customer who decided that I was not playing a game of chance. And that was another punch. Broke my jaw. Got me sitting down and wondering if there was an easier way to make a living. What I did was I took the stuff I knew, which was essentially cheating at cards and picking locks and running the shell game, and turned it into an act and made less money initially, but I had a better chance at survival. And then I've just been in the process of becoming more and more legitimate through the years, and now I'm a judge. Who would have thought?
So how did you learn to pick locks and run a shell game?
Well, it was the stuff that fascinated me. When I was a kid in Chicago, I hung around a place called the Ambassador Hotel, and they had a room there called the Pump Room. And that's where the old guys would come and play cards. And my dad was a salesman, and I don't recall exactly why I was spending afternoons there, but I do recall watching these old guys play cards, and Chicago is a big town for magicians and card hustlers. So when I was very young, a fellow sat me down and taught me the three-card Monty, and that kind of pointed me towards easy money. And I just learned what I could to become what they call a wise guy. Unfortunately, that was the early 50s, and the day of the wise guy was really ending. The day of the street entrepreneur was kind of vanishing. They flourished in the post-war era. But then, fortunately, the history of it overlapped neatly with street performers who made a comeback in the 60s when I was a teenager. And so I was able to step right into that.
So you learned how to do shell games. You also learned how to pick locks. Did you use that to rob people?
Oh, no. No, I didn't. Really, my only run-ins with the law were over hustling on the street. I did get busted once in New Orleans for a couple of nights and the irony was that was after I had stopped actually hustling with the shell game and was doing it as a kind of a bunco demonstration.
What was your rap when you were running the shell game?
Little game of hanky-poo, two for me and one for you. Hey, diddle-diddle, it's the one in the middle. Which one is it now? And on, as the game required.
So how are you discovered after playing the streets and then playing casinos? How did you make it onto television?
Well, it all happened kind of quick. I was in town with my wife. She was raised in Los Angeles, and we were in town visiting her folks and playing the Magic Castle, which is a nightclub for magicians here in town. And I was doing my act, which at that time consisted of a stage version of the three-card Monty and the demonstration of the holdout. And Kenny Rogers' manager, Ken Cragen, saw me, and at that time, Kenny's big song was The Gambler. And he thought that my material was very appropriate to go along with Kenny's hit, and he asked me to open for Kenny in Las Vegas, which I did, and I was seen there, asked to do Saturday Night Live, which I did 9 or 10 times over the years. The Charles Brothers had a new show. Glenn and Les Charles had a new show in mind called Cheers, and they thought that a con man would be a very natural character in the bar. So they hired me to do the first season of Cheers, and somebody saw me on Cheers and thought that I was an actor playing a part as opposed to a guy just doing what he knew, and they gave me night court. And by the time they realized I wasn't an actor, I had already signed a 5-year contract. Joke's on them.
Do you think of yourself as having used any cons to get your role on night court?
Well, based on that story, I'd say that's exactly how I did it. I mean, it was a little inadvertent, but it was by playing a con man. I mean, I hadn't acted, I hadn't taken lessons, and I hadn't auditioned. I had simply done what I knew, and that led to playing Judge Harry Stone.
Harry Anderson, speaking to Terry Gross in 1989. 6 episodes of his quirky sitcom are being released next week in a DVD collection called Television Favorites Night Court. Coming up, The Pajama Game. This is Fresh Air. A revival of the classic musical comedy The Pajama Game opened on Broadway last night to great reviews. New York Times critic Ben Brantley called it a delicious reinvention. Terry Teachout, writing in the Wall Street Journal, said, "The staging is a knockout, the sets and costumes are good-looking, the cast is uniformly appealing, and everybody knows how to sing." Well, that part of the rave you could have anticipated, because the singing star on stage is Harry Connick Jr.
Hey there, you with the stars in your eyes. Love never made a fool of you. You used to be too wise. Hey there, you on that high-flying cloud. Though she won't throw a crumb to you, you think someday she'll come to you. Better forget her.
The Pajama Game is set in 1954 in a pajama factory in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, where the workers are preparing to strike if they don't get a raise. The show also stars Kelly O'Hara. Richard Adler and Jerry Ross wrote the music and lyrics for The Pajama Game, which also includes the popular number Hernando's Hideaway. Adler and Ross quickly followed that with Damn Yankees. Both shows were directed by George Abbott. In 1955, the New York Times called Adler and Ross Broadway's hottest young composers. But later that year, everything changed for Adler when his songwriting partner, Jerry Ross, died at the age of 29. In 1990, Terry Gross spoke with Richard Adler about the original production of The Pajama Game, which starred John Raitt.
You work collaboratively with Jerry Ross, and you both wrote words and music, right?
Right.
What were the mechanics of the relationship?
Well, there were no mechanics to the relationship. We wrote every which way imaginable. Sometimes I would come in with a lyric or a melody, and he would elaborate on it. Sometimes he would, like for instance with Steam Heat. I went to the bathroom one day, and when I got in there, I decided I'm not leaving this room until I've written a song about something in the room. So there were certain things you can't write about in a bathroom. Then all of a sudden the radiator started clanging and hissing, and I got the idea for Steam Heat. I wrote out a full chorus of it, got out of the bathroom, called Jerry, sang it to him over the phone. We got together the next day and elaborated on it. That's one way that we wrote.
Yeah, I got steam heat, I got steam heat, I got steam heat, but I need your love to keep away the cold. I got steam heat, I got steam heat, I got steam heat, but I can't get warm without your hand to hold. The radiator's hissing still, I need your kissing to keep me from freezing each night. I got a hot water bottle, but nothing I got will take the place of you holding me tight. I got steam heat.
When you wrote a song for the Pajama Game, who would you have to play the song for before it got okayed?
George Abbott. Period.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm.
And what kind of critiques would he give you?
Critiques? None. He would say yes or no. For the dictaphone song, he wanted a song in a that could be dictated into a dictaphone machine. They didn't have tapes in those days. They had dictaphone machines. So we wrote a terrible song called Dear Babe. And he thought it was terrible. We thought it was terrible, too. He said, give me something a little bit more unique. And then we wrote Hey There. And he liked that a lot and went into the show. Then when it was in the show, being a young, idiotic, and compulsive man, I suddenly thought, gee, this song, it's very lovely, but it maybe isn't commercial enough. And I wrote 6 songs trying to write around Hey There to get it out of the show. And Abbott kept saying, don't bother me, I like Hey There.
Hey there, you with the stars in your eyes, love never made a fool of you. You used to be too wise. Hey there, you on that high flying cloud, though she won't throw a crumb to you, you think someday she'll come to you. Better forget her, her with her nose in the air. She has you dancing on a string. Break it and she won't care. Will you take this advice I hand you like a brother, or are you not seeing things too clear? Are you just too far gone to hear? Is it all going in one ear and out the other?
After the success of Pajama Game, you very quickly got involved in writing the words and music for Damn Yankees. How did Damn Yankees happen so quickly on the heels of Pajama Game?
Well, Pajama Game was a big hit, and Mr. Abbott wanted to get the same team together and write another show, and he, the boys, that is Hal Prince and Bobby Griffith, came up with a book called The Year the Yankees Lost the Pennant. Now, we knew that baseball was singularly unsuccessful in the theater, motion pictures, etc. There had never been a hit. It was a taboo. But we tackled it anyway. We all liked the property. And we wrote Damn Yankees, following on the heels of Pajama Game.
Was it easier to write a Broadway show the second time around?
No, much harder.
Why was it harder?
First of all, we had written with much greater abandon when we wrote Pajama Game because we didn't know what to be afraid of, like the critics. Though the critics were all marvelous to us in Pajama Game, we began to fear that they might not be in Damn Yankees, so we got a little bit apprehensive about that.
One of the best-known songs from Damn Yankees is You've Gotta Have Heart.
You've Gotta Have Heart is the best-known song I think probably I've ever written. And it became a tremendous hit in the show. It stopped the show from the first performance on.
Now listen to me, you guys. This game of baseball is only one half skill. The other half is something else. Something bigger. You gotta have heart. All you really need is heart. When the odds are saying you'll never win, that's when the grin should start. You gotta have hope.
Your songwriting partner, Jerry Ross, died after Damn Yankees at the age of 29. You were devastated by that.
I certainly was. I was devastated, and that was 35 years ago, and I'm still devastated by it. He was like my brother. He was my beloved friend, my younger brother, my collaborator. He was everything to me at the time.
Cole Porter gave you the advice of, just write by yourself now. Your partner's gone. Write by yourself. Why was it so difficult for you to write by yourself?
Well, if you're married and you lose your spouse, it's difficult to adjust to single life. If you're writing as a team successfully, very successfully, after a lot of hard work, and suddenly half of the team is Nevermore, it's difficult. It's hard to adjust. It's hard to explain. So I took Mr. Porter's advice, and it took many years of struggle before I was able to succeed once again. I really literally had to start all over.
What did the new success come with?
Well, it came with songs like Everybody Loves a Lover, which came about 2.5 years later. It came with the writing of probably the most successful jingles. At the prices I got to be charging, I call them advertising musicals. It came later on with the writing of, with the commissioning of classical pieces like Wilderness Suite, the Statue of Liberty Centennial piece, The Lady Remembers, the Sesquicentennial of Chicago piece, and other things.
Composer and lyricist Richard Adler speaking with Terry Gross in 1990. The musical The Pajama Game, which he wrote with Jerry Ross, opened on Broadway in a new revival last night to rave reviews. Coming up, Tap's greatest duo. This is Fresh Air. Films starring some of the great black entertainers of the 20th century are now available on DVD. They include performances by Ethel Waters, Fats Waller, Lena Horne, Bill Bojangles Robinson, and Cab Calloway. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz says that some of the best of these new releases show off the amazing dance team of Harold and Fayard Nicholas, better known as the Nicholas Brothers. Fayard Nicholas died last month. He was 91. Harold Nicholas died in 2000 at the age of 79.
At the end of The Pirate, a 1948 MGM Technicolor musical starring Judy Garland and Gene Kelly, there's a marvelous dance routine to Cole Porter's Be a Clown. Kelly is joined by two black dancers, Harold and Fayard Nicholas, who leap and tumble over one another. Yet what at first seems merely acrobatic is done with the grace and elegance, the musical invention and interaction of the highest level of dancing. In The Pirate, the brothers had nothing else to do earlier in the film. To its eternal shame, Hollywood did not allow African-American entertainers to appear as major characters in films with primarily white casts. They could play wisecracking or dim-witted servants, or they could go to Europe like Josephine Baker, whose electrifying talent and beauty were more important there than her race. Her three films made in France are now on DVD. In this country, the only chance these performers had to do any real acting was either in the low-budget subculture of so-called race films or in a handful of high-minded, big-budget Hollywood landmarks with all-black casts made by white directors. A 1943 musical called Stormy Weather, just issued on DVD by Fox, is a flimsy excuse to string together some of the most remarkable song and dance numbers ever filmed. It's significant that on the three new DVDs from Warner, King Vidor's Hallelujah, Mark Connelly's movie version of his Pulitzer Prize-winning play The Green Pastures, and Cabin in the Sky, the first film directed by Vincent Minnelli, there's a written disclaimer that reminds us that these films are the product of their time and warns us not to forget our tradition of racism, even in the entertainment industry. Yet the best moments transcend painful issues, like when the extraordinary Ethel Waters in Cabin in the Sky sings one of the great songs she introduced, Vernon Duke's Taking a Chance on Love.
Here I go again. Again, all aglow again, taking a chance on love. Here I slide again, about to take that ride again, starry-eyed again, taking a chance on love. I thought that cars were a frame-up, that I never would try. Now I'm taking the game up, and the ace of hearts is high. Things are mending now, I see a rainbow blending now. We'll have our happy ending now, taking a chance on love.
Special bonus features on the new Warner DVDs include some real rarities. Three short films made by the Nicholas Brothers when they were still kids. They were amazing. In Pie, Pie, Blackbird from 1932, 11-year-old Harold and 18-year-old Fayard do a tap dance that's so hot, the Blackbird Pie, which opens up to reveal the great U.B. Blake and his orchestra inside, begins to sizzle and smoke. Their big number in Stormy Weather was admired by both Fred Astaire and George Balanchine. At the climax, the brothers play leapfrog down a flight of high steps and land in a series of hair-raising splits from which they rise in slow motion without using their hands to push themselves up. In Orchestra Wives, one of only two films featuring Glenn Miller and his orchestra, they sing I've Got a Gal in Kalamazoo, and do a dance in which Harold does a double spin in the air, lands in a split, then literally walks up the side of a column into a somersault and another split.
ABC, D, E, F, G, H. I got a gal.
Where?
In Kalamazoo.
Kalamazoo.
I don't want to boast, but I know she's a toast of Kalamazoo.
Zoo, 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 zoo.
Years have gone by. My, my, how she grew.
Man, did she grew.
I liked her looks when I carried her books in Kalamazoo.
Zoo, 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 zoo.
I'm gonna send a wire.
Hopping on a flyer.
Leaving today. Am I dreaming?
I can hear screaming. Hiya, Mr. Jackson.
Everything's okay.
A-L-A-M-A-Z-O.
Oh, what a gal. A real pipperoo.
She's a fine chick.
I'm gonna make my bid for the freckle-faced kid I'm hurrying to. Going to Michigan to see the sweetest gal in Kalamazoo.
There are very few films in which either of the Nicholas brothers played an actual character. The only one I've seen is Robert Townsend's 1991 The Five Heartbeats, about a group of black kids who form a singing group that makes it all the way to the top. Harold Nicholas plays a retired hoofer who helps them polish their dance movements and ends up the group's mascot. It's a touching performance, and it's great to see his character throw down his cane and do an eye-popping little routine. It also underlines all those wasted years when he and his brother should have been playing the leading roles.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix and teaches English at the University of Massachusetts, Boston. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. WHYY's executive producer of national radio programming is Elizabeth Perez Luna. For Terry Gross, I'm David Bianculli.
Support for NPR comes from Dial Press Trade Paperbacks, publisher of The Train to Lo Wu, a collection of stories set in modern-day Hong Kong by Jess Rowe. From the Susan and John Turbin Foundation for the NPR Fund for New Initiatives, helping to develop NPR's new programming and new media. And from GM, committed to energy independence with vehicles that run on gasoline or E85 ethanol. Details at livegreengoyellow.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
A hardened young South African gang leader steals a woman's car, then finds out her baby is in the back seat. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with the director and the star of the South African film Tsotsi. It's been nominated for an Academy Award for Best Foreign Film. Join us for the next Fresh Air.